No mind at all. Gone. That won't happen, Frank, Bobby said. We won't let it. We'll find out who you are and what it all means. Bobby, Julie said warningly. Hmm? He smiled obtusely. She got up from her desk and went into the bathroom. Ah, jeez. Bobby followed her, closed the door, and turned on the fan. Julie, we have to help the poor guy. The man is obviously experiencing psychotic fugues. He's doing these things in a blacked-out condition. He gets up in the middle of the night, yeah, but he's not sleepwalking. He's awake, alert, but in a fugue state. He could steal, kill, and not remember any of it. Julie, I'll bet you that was his own blood on his hands. He may be having blackouts, fugues, whatever you want to call them, but he's not a killer. How much do you want to bet? And you still say he's not a thief? On a regular basis, he wakes up with a bag full of money. Doesn't know where he got it, but he's not a thief? You think maybe he counterfeits money during these amnesiac spells? No. No, I'm sure you think he's too nice to be a counterfeiter. Listen, he said, we've got to go with gut feeling sometimes. And my gut feeling is that Frank is a good guy. Even Clint thinks he's a good guy. Greeks are notoriously gregarious. They like everybody. You telling me Clint is your typical Greek social animal? Are we talking about the same Clint, last name Karagiosis? Guy who looks as if he was cast from concrete and smiles about as often as a cigar store Indian? The light in the bathroom was too bright. It bounced off the mirror, white sink, white walls, and white ceramic tile. Thanks to the glare and Bobby's good-natured, if iron-willed, determination to help Pollard, Julie was getting a headache. She closed her eyes. Pollard's pathetic, she admitted. Want to go back in there and hear him out? All right, but damn it, don't tell him we'll help him until we've heard everything, all right? They returned to the office. The sky no longer looked like cold, scorched metal. It was darker than before, and churning, molten. Though only the mildest breeze stirred at ground level, strong winds apparently were at work in higher altitudes, for dense black thunderheads were being harried inland from the sea. Like metal filings drawn to magnets, shadows had piled up in some corners. Julie reached for the switch to snap on the overhead fluorescence. Then she saw Bobby looking around with obvious pleasure at the soft, lustrous, burnished brass surfaces of the lamps, in the way the polished oak end tables and coffee tables glimmered in the fall of warm, buttery light. And she left the switch unflicked. She sat behind her desk again, Bobby perched on the edge of it, legs dangling. Clint clicked on the tape recorder, and Julie said, Frank, Mr. Pollard, before you continue your story, I'd like you to answer a few important questions for me. In spite of the blood on your hands and the scratches, you believe you're incapable of hurting anyone?
Yeah.
Except maybe in self-defense. And you don't think you're a thief?
No, I can't. I don't see myself as a thief, no.
Then why haven't you gone to the police for help? He was silent. He clutched the open flight bag on his lap and peered into it, as if Julie was speaking to him from its interior. She said, because if you really feel you're an innocent man in all regards, the police are best equipped to help you find out who you are and who's pursuing you. You know what I think? I think you're not as certain of your innocence as you pretend. You know how to hotwire a car, and although any man with reasonable knowledge of automobiles could perform that trick, it's at least an indication of criminal experience. And then there's the money, all that money. Bags full of it. You don't remember committing any crimes, but in your heart, you're convinced you have, so you're afraid to go to the cops.
That's part of it, he acknowledged.
She said, you do understand, I hope, that if we take your case, and if we turn up evidence that you've committed a criminal act, we'll have to convey that information to the police.
Of course. But I figure if I went to the cops first, they wouldn't even look for the truth. They'd make up their minds that I was guilty of something even before I finished telling my story.
And of course we wouldn't do that, Bobby said, turning his head to favor Julie with a meaningful look. Pollard said, instead of helping me, they'd look around for some recent crimes to pin on me.
The police don't work that way, Julie assured him. Of course they do, Bobby said mischievously. He slid off the desk and began to pace back and forth from the Uncle Scrooge poster to the one of Mickey Mouse. Haven't we seen him do it 1,000 times on TV shows? Haven't we all read Hammett and Chandler? Mr. Pollard, Julie said, I was a police officer once. Proves my point, Bobby said. Frank, if you'd gone to the cops, you'd no doubt already have been booked, tried, convicted, and sentenced to 1,000 years. There's a more important reason I can't go to the cops. That would be like going public. Maybe the press would hear about me and be real eager to do a story, you know, about this poor guy with amnesia and bags of cash. Then he'd know where to find me, and I can't risk that. Bobby said, who is he, Frank? The man who was chasing me the other night. The way you said it, I thought you remembered his name, had a specific person in mind. No. I don't know who he is. I'm not even entirely sure what he is. But I know he'll come for me again if he learns where I am, so I've got to keep my head down. From the sofa, Clint said, I better flip the tape over. They waited while he popped the cassette out of the recorder. Although it was only 3 o'clock, the day was in the grip of a false twilight, indistinguishable from the real one. The breeze at ground level was striving to match the wind that drove the clouds at higher altitudes. A thin fog poured in from the west, exhibiting none of the lazy motion with which fogs usually advanced, swirling and churning, a molten flux that seemed to be trying to solder the earth to the thunderheads above. When Clint had the recorder going again, Julie said, Frank, is that the end of it? When you woke Saturday morning wearing new clothes with a paper bag full of money on the bed beside you? No. Not the end. He raised his head, but he didn't look at her. He stared past her at the dreary day beyond the windows, though he seemed to be gazing at something much farther away than Newport Beach. Maybe it's never going to end. From the second flight bag, out of which he had earlier withdrawn the bloody shirt and the sample of black sand, he produced a 1-pint mason jar of the type used to store home-canned fruits and vegetables, with a sturdy hinged glass lid that clamped on a rubber gasket. The jar was filled with what appeared to be rough, uncut, dully gleaming gems. Some were more polished than others. They sparkled, flared. Frank released the lid, tipped the jar, and poured some of the contents onto the imitation blonde wood Formica desktop. Julie leaned forward. Bobby stepped in for a closer look. The less irregular gems were round, oval, teardrop, or lozenge-shaped. Some aspects of each stone were smoothly curved. Some were naturally beveled with lots of sharp edges. Other gems were lumpy, jagged, pocked. Several were as large as fat grapes. Others as small as peas. They were all red, though they varied in their degree of coloration. They vigorously refracted the light, a pool of scarlet glitter on the pale surface of the desk. The gems marshaled the diffused glow of the lamps through their prisms and cast shimmering spears of crimson toward the ceiling and one wall, where the acoustic tiles and sheetrock appeared to be marked by luminous wounds. Rubies? Bobby asked. They don't look quite like rubies, Julie said. What are they, Frank? I don't know. They might not even be valuable. Where'd you get them? Saturday night. I couldn't sleep much at all, just minutes at a time. I kept tossing and turning and popping awake again as soon as I dozed off, afraid to sleep. And I didn't nap Sunday afternoon. But yesterday evening I was so exhausted I couldn't keep my eyes open anymore. I slept in my clothes, and when I got up this morning my pants pockets were full of these things. Julie plucked one of the more polished stones from the pile and held it to her right eye, looking through it toward the nearest lamp. Even in its raw state, the gem's color and clarity were exceptional. They might, as Frank implied, be only semi-precious, but she suspected they were, in fact, of considerable value. Bobby said, "Well, why are you keeping them in a mason jar?" "Because I had to go buy one anyway to keep this," Frank said. From the flight bag, he produced a large quart-sized jar and placed it on the desk. Julie turned to look at it and was so startled that she dropped the gem she'd been examining. An insect, nearly as large as her hand, lay in that glass container. Though it had a dorsal shell like a beetle, midnight black with blood-red markings around the entire rim, the thing within the carapace more closely resembled a spider than a beetle. It had the 8 sturdy, hairy legs of a tarantula. "What the hell?" Bobby grimaced. He was mildly entomophobic. When he encountered any insect more formidable than a housefly, he called upon Julie to capture or kill it while he watched from a distance. "Is it alive?" Julie asked. "Not now," Frank said. Two forearms, like miniature lobster claws, extended from under the front of the thing's shell, one on each side of the head. Though they differed from the appendages of a lobster in that the pincers were far more highly articulated than those of any common crustacean, they somewhat resembled hands, with 4 curved, chitinous segments, each jointed at the base. The edges were wickedly serrated. "If that thing had got a hold of your finger," Bobby said, "I bet it could snip it off. You say it was alive, Frank?" "When I woke up this morning, it was crawling on my chest." "Good God!" Bobby paled visibly. "It was sluggish." "Yeah? Well, it sure looks quick as a damned cockroach." "I think it was dying already," Frank said. "I screamed, brushed it off, and it just lay there on its back on the floor, kicking kind of feebly for a few seconds. Then it was still. I stripped the case off one of the bed pillows and scooped the thing into it and knotted the top so it wouldn't crawl away if it was still alive. Then I discovered the gems in my pockets, so I bought 2 mason jars, one for the bug. And it hasn't moved since I put it in there, so I figure it's dead." "You ever see anything like that?" "No," Julie said. "Thank God, no," Bobby agreed. He was not leaning over the jar for a closer look as Julie was. In fact, he had taken a step back from the desk as if he thought the creepy crawler might be able, in a wink, to cut its way through the glass. Julie picked up the jar and turned it so she could look at the bug face on. Its satin black head was almost as big as a plum and half hidden under the carapace. Multifaceted, muddy yellow eyes were set high on the sides of the face, and under each of them was what appeared to be another eye, a third smaller than the one above it, and reddish-blue. Queer patterns of tiny holes, 6 thorn-like extrusions, and 3 clusters of silky-looking hairs marked the otherwise smooth, shiny surface of that hideous countenance. Its small mouth, open now, was a circular orifice in which she saw what appeared to be rings of tiny but sharp teeth. Staring at the occupant of the jar, Frank said, "Whatever the hell I'm mixed up in, it's a bad thing. It's a real bad thing. And I'm afraid." Bobby twitched. In a thoughtful voice, speaking more to himself than to them, Bobby said, "Bad thing." Putting the jar down, Julie said, "Frank, we'll take the case." "All right," Clint said, and switched off the recorder. Turning away from the desk, heading toward the bathroom, Bobby said, "Julie, I need to see you alone for a moment." For the third time, they stepped into the bathroom together, closed the door behind them, and switched on the fan. Bobby's face was grayish, like a highly detailed portrait done in pencil. Even his freckles were colorless. His customarily merry blue eyes were not merry now. He said, "Are you crazy? You told him we'll take the case." Julie blinked in surprise. "Isn't that what you wanted?"
"No."
"Oh, then I guess I heard you wrong. Must be too much wax in my ears, solid as cement. He's probably a lunatic, dangerous. Ooh, I'd better go to the doctor, have my ears professionally cleaned. This wild story he's made up is just..." She held up one hand, halting him in mid-sentence. "Get real, Bobby. He didn't imagine that bug. What is that thing? I've never even seen pictures of anything like that."
"Well, what about the money? He must have stolen it."
"Frank's no thief."
"What? Did God tell you that?
because there's no other way you could know. You only met Pollard a little more than an hour ago. You're right, she said. God told me. And I always listen to God, because if you don't listen to him, then he's likely to visit a plague of teeming locusts on you and maybe set your hair on fire with a lightning bolt. Listen, Frank's so lost, adrift, I feel sorry for him, okay? He stared at her, chewing on his pale lower lip for a moment. Then finally said, we work good together, because we complement each other. You're strong where I'm weak, and I'm strong where you're weak. In many ways, we're not at all alike, but we belong together because we fit like pieces of a puzzle. What's your point? One way we're different, but complementary, is our motivation. This line of work suits me because I get a kick out of helping people who are in trouble through no fault of their own. I like to see good triumph. Ah, sounds like comic book hero stuff, but it's the way I feel. You, on the other hand, are primarily motivated by a desire to stomp the bad guys. Yeah, sure, I like to see the bad guys all crumpled and whimpering, too, but it's not as important to me as it is to you. And, of course, you're happy to help innocent people, but with you that's secondary to the stomping and the crushing. Probably because you're still working out your rage over the murder of your mother. Bobby, if I want psychoanalysis, I'll get it in a room where the primary piece of furniture is a couch, not a toilet. Her mother had been taken hostage in a bank holdup when Julie was 12. The two perpetrators had been high on amphetamines and low on common sense and compassion. Before it was all over, 5 of the 6 hostages were dead, and Julie's mother was not the lucky one. Turning to the mirror, Bobby looked at her reflection as if he was uncomfortable meeting her eyes directly. My point is, suddenly you're acting like me, and that's no good. That destroys our balance, disrupts the harmony of this relationship, and it's the harmony that has always kept us alive, successful and alive. You want to take this case because you're fascinated, it excites your imagination, and because you'd like to help Frank, he's so pitiful. I mean, where's your usual outrage? I'll tell you where it is. You don't have any, because at this moment anyway, there's no one to elicit it. No bad guy. Okay, there's the guy that he says chased him that night, but we don't even know if he's real or just a figment of Frank's fantasy. Without an obvious bad guy to focus your anger, I should have to drag you into this every step of the way, and that's what I was doing. But now you're doing the dragging, and that worries me. It doesn't feel right. She let him ramble on, with their gazes locked in the mirror. And when at last he finished, she said, no, that's not your point. What do you mean? I mean, everything you just said is smoke. What's really bothering you, Robert? His reflection tried to stare down her reflection. She smiled. Come on, tell me. We never keep secrets. Bobby in the mirror looked like some bad imitation of the real Bobby Dakota. The real Bobby, her Bobby, was full of fun and life and energy. Bobby in the mirror was gray-faced, almost grim. His vitality had been sapped by worry. Robert, she prodded. You remember last Thursday when we woke, he said. The Santa Anas were blowing. We made love. I remember. And right after we'd made love, I had the strange, terrible feeling that I was going to lose you, that something out there in the wind was coming to get you. You told me about it later that night at Ozzy's when we were talking about jukeboxes, but the windstorm ended, and nothing got me. Here I am. That same night, Thursday night, I had a nightmare, the most vivid dream you can imagine. He told her about the little house on the beach, the jukebox standing in the sand, the thunderous inner voice, the bad thing is coming, the bad thing, the bad thing, and about the corrosive sea that had swallowed both of them, dissolving their flesh and dragging their bones into lightless depths. It rocked me. You can't conceive of how real it seemed. Sounds crazy, but that dream was almost more real than real life. I woke up, scared as bad as I've ever been. You were sleeping and I didn't wake you. Didn't tell you about it later because I didn't see the point of worrying you and because, well, it seems childish to put much stock in dreams. I haven't had the nightmare again. But since then, Friday, Saturday, yesterday, I've had moments when a strange anxiety sort of shivers through me, and I think maybe some bad thing is coming to get you. And now, out there in the office, Frank, said he was mixed up in a bad thing, a real bad thing. That's how he put it. And right away I made the connection. Julie, maybe this case is the bad thing I dreamed about. Maybe we shouldn't take it. She stared at Bobby in the mirror for a moment, wondering how to reassure him. Finally, she decided that because their roles had reversed, she should deal with him as Bobby would deal with her in a similar situation. Bobby would not resort to logic and reason, which were her tools, but he would charm and humor her out of a funk. Instead of responding directly to his concerns, she said, "Well, as long as we're getting things off our chests, you know what bothers me? The way you sit on my desk sometimes when we're talking to a prospective client. With some clients, it might make sense for me to sit on the desk, wearing a short skirt, showing some leg, because I've got good legs, even if I say so myself. But you never wear skirts, short or otherwise, and you don't have the gams for it anyway." "Who's talking about desks?" "I am," she said, turning away from the mirror and looking at him directly. "We leased a 7-room suite instead of 8 to save money, and by the time the rest of the staff was set up, we had only one office for ourselves, which seemed okay. There's plenty of room in there for 2 desks, but you say you don't want one. Desks are too formal for you. All you need is a couch to lie on while making calls, you say. Yet when clients come in, you sit on my desk." "Julie, Formica is a hard, nearly impervious surface, but sooner or later you'll have spent so much time sitting on my desk, it'll be marked by a permanent imprint of your ass." Because she wouldn't look at the mirror, he had to turn away from it too and face her. "Didn't you hear what I said about the dream?" "Oh, no, don't get me wrong. You've got a cute ass, Bobby, but I don't want the imprint on my desktop. Pencils will keep rolling into the depression. Dust will collect. What's going on here? I want to warn you that I'm thinking of having the top of my desk wired so I can electrify it with the flick of a switch. You sit on it then, and you'll know what a fly feels like when it settles on one of those electronic bug zappers." "You're being difficult, Julie." "Why are you being difficult?" "Frustration. I haven't gotten to stomp or crush any bad guys lately. Makes me irritable." He said, "Hey, wait a minute. You're not being difficult." "Of course I'm not." "You're being me." "Exactly." She kissed his right cheek and patted his left. "Now, let's go back out there and take the case." She opened the door and stepped out of the bathroom. With some amusement, Bobby said, "I'll be damned," and followed her into the office. Frank Pollard was talking quietly with Clint, but fell silent and looked up hopefully as they entered. Shadows clung to the corners like monks to their cloisters, and for some reason the amber glow from the 3 lamps reminded her of the scintillant and mysterious light of serried votive candles in a church. The puddle of scarlet gems still glimmered on the desk. The bug was still in a death crouch in the mason jar. "Did Clint explain our fee schedule?" she asked Pollard.
"Yes."
"Okay. In addition, we'll need $10,000 as an advance against expenses." Outside, lightning scarred the bellies of the clouds. The bruised sky ruptured, and cold rain spattered against the windows.
Violet had been awake for more than an hour, and during most of that time she had been a hawk, swooping high in the wind, darting down now and then to make a swift kill. The open sky was nearly as real to her as it was to the bird that she had invaded. She glided on thermal currents, the air offering little resistance to the sleek foredges of her wings, with only the lowering gray clouds above and the whole huddled world below. She was also aware of the shadowy bedroom in which her body, and a portion of her mind, remained. Violet and Verbena usually slept during the day, for to sleep away the night was to waste the best of times. They shared a room on the second floor, 1 king-size bed, never more than an arm's reach from each other, although usually entwined. That Monday afternoon, Verbena was still asleep, naked, on her belly, with her head turned away from her sister, occasionally mumbling wordlessly into her pillow. Her warm flank pressed against Violet. Even while Violet was with the hawk, she was aware of her twin's body heat, smooth skin, slow rhythmic breathing, sleepy murmurings, and distinct scent. She smelled the dust in the room, too, and the stale odor of the long, unwashed sheets, and the cats, of course. She not only smelled the cats, which slept upon the bed and the surrounding floor or lay lazily licking themselves, but lived in each of them. While a part of her consciousness remained in her own pale flesh, and a part soared with the feathered predator, other aspects of her held tenancy in each of the cats, 25 of them now that poor Samantha was gone. Simultaneously, Violet experienced the world through her own senses, through those of the hawk, and through the 50 eyes and 25 noses and 50 ears and 100 paws and 25 tongues of the pack. She could smell her own body odor not merely through her own nose, but through the noses of all the cats, the faint soapy residue of last night's bath, the pleasantly lingering tang of lemon-scented shampoo, the staleness that always followed sleep, halitosis ripe with the vapor ghosts of the raw eggs and onions and raw liver that she had eaten that morning before going to bed with the rising sun. Each member of the pack had a sharper olfactory sense than she did, and each perceived her scent differently from the way she did. They found her natural fragrance strange, yet comforting, intriguing, yet familiar. She could smell, see, hear, and feel herself through her sister's senses as well, for she was always inextricably linked with Verbena. At will, she could swiftly enter or disengage from the minds of other life forms, but Verbena was the only other person with whom she could join in that way. It was a permanent link, which they had shared since birth, and though Violet could disengage from the hawk or the cats whenever she wished, she could never disengage from her twin. Likewise, she could control the minds of animals as well as inhabit them, but she was not able to control her sister. Their link was not that of puppet master and puppet, but special and sacred. All of her life, Violet had lived at the confluence of many rivers of sensation, bathed in great churning currents of sound and scent and sight and taste and touch, experiencing the world not only through her own senses, but those of countless surrogates. For part of her childhood, she had been autistic, so overwhelmed by sensory input that she could not cope. She had turned inward to her secret world of rich, varied, and profound experience until she had learned to control the incoming flood, harnessing it instead of being swept away. Only then had she chosen to relate to the people around her, abandoning autism, and she had not learned to talk until she was 6 years old. She had never risen out of those deep, fast currents of extraordinary sensation to stand on the comparatively dry bank of life on which other people existed. But at least she had learned to interact with her mother, Candy, and others to a limited degree. Verbena had never coped half as well as Violet, and evidently never would. Having chosen a life almost exclusively defined by sensation, she exhibited little or no concern for the exercise and development of her intellect. She had never learned to talk, showed only the vaguest interest in anyone but her sister, and immersed herself with joyous abandonment in the ocean of sensory stimuli that surged around her. Running as a squirrel, flying as a hawk or gull, rutting as a cat, loping and killing as a coyote, drinking cool water from a stream through the mouth of a raccoon or field mouse, entering the mind of a bitch in heat as other dogs mounted her, simultaneously sharing the terror of the cornered rabbit and the savage excitement of the predatory fox, Verbena enjoyed a breadth of life that no one else but Violet could ever know. And she preferred the constant thrill of immersion in the wildness of the world to the comparatively mundane existence of other people. Now, although Verbena still slept, a part of her was with Violet in the soaring hawk, for even sleep did not necessitate the complete disconnection of their links to other minds. The continuous sensory input of the lesser species was not only the primary fabric from which their lives were cut, but the stuff of which their dreams were formed as well. Under storm clouds that grew darker by the minute, the hawk glided high over the canyon behind the Pollard property. It was hunting. Far below, among pieces of dried and broken tumbleweed between spiny clumps of gorse, a fat mouse broke cover. It scurried along the canyon floor, alert for signs of enemies at ground level, but oblivious to the feathered death that observed it from far above. Instinctively aware that the mouse could hear the flapping of wings from a great distance and would scramble into the nearest haven at the first sound of them, the hawk silently tucked its wings back, half folding them against its body, and dived steeply, angling toward the rodent. Though she had shared this experience countless times before, Violet held her breath as they plummeted 1,200 feet, dropping past ground level and farther down into the ravine. And though she actually was safely on her back in bed, her stomach seemed to turn within her, and a primal terror swelled within her breast even as she let out a thin squeal of pleasurable excitement. On the bed beside Violet, her sister also softly cried out. On the canyon floor, the mouse froze, sensing onrushing doom, but not certain from which quarter it was coming. The hawk deployed its wings as foils at the last moment. Abruptly, the true substance of the air became apparent and provided a welcome breaking resistance. Letting its hindquarters precede it, extending its legs, opening its claws, the hawk seized the mouse even as the creature reacted to the sudden spread of wings and tried to flee. Though remaining with the hawk, Violet entered the mind of the mouse an instant before the predator had taken it. She felt the icy satisfaction of the hunter and the hot fear of the prey. From the perspective of the hawk, she felt the plump mouse's flesh puncture and split under the sharp and powerful assault of her talons. And from the perspective of the mouse, she was racked by searing pain and was aware of a dreadful rupturing within. The bird peered down at the squealing rodent in its grasp and shivered with a wild sense of dominance and power, with a realization that hunger would again be sated. It loosed a caw of triumph that echoed along the canyon. Feeling small and helpless in the grip of its winged assailant, in the thrall of excruciating fear so intense as to be strangely akin to the most exquisite of sensory pleasures, the mouse looked up into the steely, merciless eyes and ceased to struggle, went limp, resigned itself to death. It saw the fierce beak descending, was aware of being rended, but no longer felt pain, only numb resignation. Then, a brief moment of shattering bliss. Then, nothing. Nothing. The hawk tipped back its head and let bloody ribbons and warm knots of flesh fall down its gullet. On the bed, Violet turned on her side to face her sister. Having been shaken from sleep by the power of the experience with the hawk, Verbena came into Violet's arms. Naked, pelvis to pelvis, belly to belly, breasts to breasts, the twins held each other and shuddered uncontrollably. Violet gasped against Verbena's tender throat, and through her link with Verbena's mind, she felt that hot flood of her own breath and the warmth it brought to her sister's skin. They made wordless sounds and clung to each other, and their frantic breathing did not begin to subside until the hawk tore the last red sliver of nourishing meat from the mouse's hide, and, with a flurry of wings, threw itself into the sky again. Below was the Pollard property, the Eugenia hedge, the gabled slate-roofed weathered-looking house, the 20-year-old Buick that had belonged to their mother and that Candy sometimes drove, clusters of primrose burning with red and yellow and purple blooms in a narrow and untended flower bed that extended the length of the decrepit back porch. Violet also saw Candy far below, at the northeast corner of the sprawling property. Still holding fast to her sister, gracing Verbena's throat and cheek and temple with a lace of gentle kisses, Violet simultaneously directed the hawk to circle above her brother. Through the bird, she watched him as he stood head bowed at their mother's grave, mourning her as he had mourned her every day without exception since her death those many years ago. Violet did not mourn. Her mother had been as much a stranger to her as anyone in the world, and she had felt nothing special at the woman's passing. Indeed, because Candy was gifted too, Violet felt closer to him than she had to her mother, which was not saying much because she did not really know him or care a great deal about him. How could she be close to anyone if she could not enter his mind and live with him, through him? That incredible intimacy was what welded her to Verbena, and it marked the myriad relationships she enjoyed with all the fowl and fauna that populated nature's world. She simply did not know how to relate to anyone without that intense innermost connection. And if she could not love, she could not mourn. Far below the wheeling hawk, Candy dropped to his knees beside the grave.
Monday afternoon. Thomas sat at his work table, making a picture poem. Derek helped, or thought he did. He sorted through a box of magazine clippings. He chose pictures, gave them to Thomas. If the picture was right, Thomas trimmed it, pasted it on the page. Most of the time, it wasn't right. So he put it aside and asked for another picture, and another, until Derek gave him something he could use. He didn't tell Derek the awful truth. The awful truth was he wanted to make the poem by himself. But he couldn't hurt Derek's feelings. Derek was hurt enough. Too much. Being dumb really hurt, and Derek was dumber than Thomas. Derek was dumber looking, too, which was more hurt. His forehead sloped more than Thomas's, his nose was flatter, and his head had a squashy shape. Awful truth. Later, tired of making the picture poem, Thomas and Derek went to the rec room, and that was where it happened. Derek got hurt. He got hurt so much he cried. A girl did it, Mary, in the rec room. Some people were playing a game of marbles in one corner. Some were watching TV. Thomas and Derek were sitting on a couch near some windows, being sociable when anyone came around. The aides always wanted people at the home to be sociable. It was good for you to be sociable. When no one came around to be sociable with them, Thomas and Derek were watching hummingbirds at a feeder that hung outside the windows. Hummingbirds didn't really hum, but they zipped around and were a lot of fun to watch. Mary, who was new at the home, didn't zip around and wasn't fun to watch, but she hummed a lot. No, she buzzed. Buzz, 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 all the time. Mary knew about IQs. She said they really mattered, IQs. And maybe they did, though Thomas had never heard of them and didn't understand what they were, but then a lot of things he didn't understand were important. He knew what eyes were, of course. He knew a cue was a stick you hit balls with because they had a pool table right there in the rec room, near where he and Derek were sitting, though nobody used it much. He figured it would be a bad thing, real bad, if you stuck yourself in the eye with a cue, but this Mary said IQs were good, and she had a big one for a Downs kid. "I'm a high-end moron," she said, real happy with herself, you could tell. Thomas didn't know what a moron was, but he couldn't see a high end to Mary anywhere. She was fat and mostly droopy all over. "You're probably a moron too, Thomas, but you ain't high end like me. I'm almost normal, and you ain't as close normal as me." All this only confused Thomas. It confused Derek even more, you could tell. And in his thick and sometimes hard to understand voice, Derek said, "Me? No moron." He shook his head. "Go away," he smiled. "Go away." Mary laughed at him. "You ain't no cowboy, or ever going to be. What you are is an imbecile." They had to ask her to say it a few times before they got it, but even then they didn't really get it. They could say it, but didn't know what it was any more than they knew what one of those IQs looked like. "You've got your normal people," Mary said, "then morons under them, then imbeciles who are dumber than morons, and then you've got idiots who are dumber than even imbeciles. Me, I'm a high-end moron, and I ain't going to be here forever. I'm going to be good, behave, work hard, be normal, and someday go back to a halfway house." Halfway where? Derek asked, which was what Thomas wondered, too. Mary laughed at him. Halfway to being normal, which is more than you'll ever be, you poor damn imbecile. This time, Derek realized she was looking down on him, making fun, and he tried not to cry, but he did. He got red in the face and cried. And Mary grinned sort of wild. She was all puffed up, excited, like she'd won some big prize. She'd used a bad word, damn, and should be ashamed, but she wasn't, you could tell. She said the other word again, which Thomas now saw was a bad word, too. Imbecile. And she kept saying it until poor Derek got up and ran. And even then, she shouted it after him. Thomas went back to their room looking for Derek, and Derek was in the closet with the door shut, bawling. Some of the aides came in and talked to Derek real nice, but he didn't want to come out of the closet. They had to talk to him a long time to get him to come out of there, but even then, he couldn't stop crying. And so after a while, they had to give him something. Once in a while, when you were sick, like with flu, the aides asked you to take something, which meant a pill of one shape or another, one color or another, little or big. But when they had to give you something, it always meant a needle, which was a bad thing. They never had to give something to Thomas because he was always good, but sometimes Derek, nice as he was, got to feeling so bad about himself that he couldn't stop crying. And sometimes he hit himself. Just hit himself in the face until he broke himself open and got blood on himself. And even then, he wouldn't stop. So they had to give him something for his own good. Derek never hit anyone else. He was nice, but for his own good, he sometimes had to be made to relax, or sometimes even made to sleep, which was what happened that day. Mary, the high-end moron, called him an imbecile. After Derek was made to sleep, one of the aides sat beside Thomas at the work table. It was Kathy. Thomas liked Kathy. She was older than Julie, but not as old as somebody's mother. She was pretty, not as pretty as Julie, but pretty, with a nice voice and eyes you weren't afraid to look into. She took one of Thomas's hands in both of hers. She asked if he was okay. He said he was. But he really wasn't, and she knew it. They talked a while. That helped, being sociable. She told him about Mary, so he'd understand, and that helped too. She's so frustrated, Thomas. She was out there in the world for a while at a halfway house, and she even had a part-time job, making a little money of her own. She was trying so hard. But it didn't work. She had too many problems, so she had to be institutionalized again. I think she regrets what she did to Derek. She's just so disappointed that she needed to feel superior to someone. I was out in the world once, Thomas said. I know you were, honey. With my dad, then with my sister, and Bobby. Did you like it out there? Some of it scared me. But when I was with Julie and Bobby, I liked that part. On his bed, Derek was snoring. The afternoon was half gone. The sky was getting ugly stormy. The room had shadows everywhere. Only the desk lamp was on. Kathy's face looked pretty in the lamp glow. Her skin was like peach-colored satin. He knew what satin was like. Julie once had a dress of satin. For a while, he and Kathy were quiet. Then he said, "Sometimes it's hard." She put her hand on his head, smoothed his hair. "Yeah, I know, Thomas. I know." She was so nice. He didn't know why he started to cry when she was so nice, but he did. Maybe it was because she was so nice. Kathy scooted her chair closer to his. He leaned against her. She put her arms around him. He cried and cried. Not hard, terrible crying like Derek. Soft. But he couldn't stop. He tried not to cry because Crying made him feel dumb, and he hated feeling dumb. Through his tears he said, "I hate feeling dumb." "You're not dumb, honey."
"Yeah, I am. I hate it. But it can't be nothing else. I try not to think about being dumb. But you can't not think about it when it's what you are and when other people aren't. And they go out in the world every day and live. But you don't go out in the world and don't even want to. But all you want to, even when you say you don't."
That was a lot for him to say, and he was surprised that he had said it all. Surprised, but also frustrated, because he wanted so bad to tell her how he felt, being dumb, being afraid of going out in the world, and he'd failed. Hadn't been able to find the right words, so the feeling was still all bottled up in him.
"Time. There's lots of time, see, when you're dumb and can't go out into the world. Lots of time to fill up. But then there really ain't enough time. Not enough for learning how not to be afraid of things. And I gotta learn not to be afraid so I can go back and be with Julie and Bobby, which I wanted to real bad, before all the time runs out. There's two big amounts of time and not enough. That sounds dumb, don't it?"
"No, Thomas, it doesn't sound dumb." He didn't move out of her arms. He wanted to be hugged. Kathy said, "You know, sometimes life is hard for everyone, even for smart people, even for the smartest of them all." With one hand, he wiped at his damp eyes.
"Is it? Sometimes? Is it hard for you?"
"Sometimes. But I believe there's a God, Thomas, and that he put us here for a reason, and that every hardship we have to face is a test, and that we're better for enduring them." He raised his head to look at her. Such nice eyes, good eyes. They were eyes that loved you, like Julie's eyes or Bobby's. Thomas said,
"God made me dumb to test me?"
"You're not dumb, Thomas. Not in some ways. I don't like to hear you call yourself dumb. You're not as smart as some, but that's not your fault. You're different, that's all. Being different is your hardship, and you're coping with it well."
"I am?"
"Beautifully. Look at you. You're not bitter. You're not sullen. You reach out to people."
"Being sociable."
She smiled, pulled a tissue from the box of Kleenex on the work table, and wiped the tears from his face. "Of all the smart people in the world, Thomas, not a one of them handles hardship better than you do, and most not as well." He knew she meant what she said, and her words made him happy, even if he didn't quite believe life was ever hard for smart people. She stayed a while, made sure he was okay, then she left. Derek was still snoring. Thomas sat at the work table, tried to make a poem. After a while, he went to the window. Rain was coming down now. It trickled on the glass. The afternoon was almost gone. Night was soon coming down on top of the rain. He put his hands against the glass. He reached into the rain, into the gray day, into the nothingness of the night that was slowly sneaking up on them. The bad thing was still out there. He could feel it. A man, but not a man. Something more than a man. Very bad. Ugly, nasty. He'd felt it for days, but he hadn't TV'd a warning to Bobby since last week because the bad thing wasn't coming any closer. It was far away right now. Julie was safe, and if he TV'd too many warnings to Bobby, then Bobby would stop paying attention to them. And when the bad thing finally showed up, Bobby wouldn't believe in it anymore, and then it would get to Julie because Bobby wouldn't be paying attention. What Thomas most feared was that the bad thing would take Julie to the bad place. Their mother went to the bad place when Thomas was 2 years old, so he'd never known her. Then their dad went to the bad place later, leaving Thomas with just Julie. He didn't mean hell. He knew about heaven and hell. Heaven was God's, the devil owned hell. If there was a heaven, he was sure his mom and dad went there. You wanted to go up to heaven if you could. Things were better there. In hell, the AIDS weren't nice. But to Thomas, the bad place wasn't just hell. It was death. Hell was a bad place, but death was the bad place. Death was a word you couldn't picture. Death meant everything stopped, went away, all your time ran out. Over, done, kaput. How could you picture that? A thing wasn't real if you couldn't picture it. He couldn't see death, couldn't get a picture of it in his head. Not if he thought about it the way other people seem to think about it. He was just too dumb. So he had to picture it in his head as a place. They said death came to take you, and it had come to take his father one night. His heart had attacked him. But if it came to take you, then it had to take you some place. And that was the bad place. It's where you were taken and never allowed to come back. Thomas didn't know what happened to a person there. Maybe nothing nasty. Except you weren't allowed to come back and see people you loved, which made it nasty enough, no matter if the food was good over there. Maybe some people went on to heaven, some to hell. But you couldn't come back from either one. So both were part of the bad place, just different rooms. And he wasn't sure heaven and hell were real. So maybe all there was in the bad place was darkness and cold and so much empty space that when you went over there, you couldn't even find the people who'd gone ahead of you. That scared him most of all. Not just losing Julie to the bad place, but not being able to find her when he went over there himself. He was already afraid of the night, all that big empty, the lid off the world. So if just the night itself was so scary, the bad place would be lots worse. It was sure to be bigger than the night, and daylight never came in the bad place. Outside, the sky got darker. Winds blew the palms, rain ran down the glass. The bad thing was far away. But it would come closer. Soon.
Candy was having one of those days when he could not accept that his mother was dead. Every time he crossed a threshold or turned a corner, he expected to see her. He thought he heard her rocking in the parlor, humming softly to herself as she knitted a new afghan. But when he went in there to look, the rocking chair was filmed with dust and draped with a shawl of cobwebs. Once he hurried into the kitchen, expecting to find her in a brightly flowered house dress, overlaid with a ruffle-trimmed white apron, dropping neat spoonsful of cookie batter on baking sheets, or perhaps mixing a cake. But, of course, she was not there. In a moment of acute emotional turmoil, Candy raced upstairs, certain that he would find his mother in bed. But when he burst into her room, he remembered that it was his room now, and that she was gone. Eventually, to jar himself out of that strange and troubling mood, he went into the backyard and stood by her lonely grave in the northeast corner of the large property. He had buried her there 7 years ago under a solemn winter sky, similar to the one that currently hid the sun, with a hawk circling above, just as one circled now. He had dug her grave, wrapped her in sheets scented with Chanel No. 5, and lowered her into the ground secretly. Because interment on private property not designated as a gravesite was against the law. If he had allowed her to be buried elsewhere, he would have had to go live there with her, for he could not have endured being separated from her mortal remains for any great length of time. Candy dropped to his knees. Over the years, The original mound of earth had settled until her grave was marked by a shallow concavity. The grass was sparser there, the blades coarse, wiry, different from the rest of the lawn, though he did not know why. Even in the months following her burial, the grass above her had not flourished. No headstone memorialized her passing. Although the backyard was sheltered by the high hedge, he could not risk calling attention to her illegal resting place. Staring at the ground around him, Candy wondered if a headstone would help him accept her death. If every day he saw her name and the date of her death deeply cut into a slab of marble, that sight should slowly but permanently engrave the loss upon his heart, sparing him days like this, when he was disturbed by a queer forgetfulness and by a hope that could never be fulfilled. He stretched out on the grave, his head turned to one side with an ear against the earth, as if he half expected to hear her speaking to him from her subterranean bed. Pressing his body hard into the unyielding ground, he longed to feel the vitality that she had once radiated, the singular energy that had flowed from her like heat from the open door of a furnace. But he felt nothing. Though his mother had been a special woman, Candy knew it was absurd to expect her corpse after 7 years to radiate even a ghost of the love that she had lavished upon him when she was alive. Nevertheless, he was grievously disappointed when not even the faintest aura shimmered upward through the dirt from her sacred bones. Hot tears burned in his eyes, and he tried to hold them back. But a faint rumble of thunder passed through the sky, and a few fat droplets of rain began to fall, and neither the storm nor his tears could be restrained. She lay only 5 or 6 feet beneath him, and he was overcome by an urge to claw his way down to her. He knew her flesh would have deteriorated, that he would find only bones cradled in a vile muck of unthinkable origin. But he wanted to hold her, and be held, even if he had to arrange her skeletal arms around himself in a staged embrace. He actually ripped at the grass and tore up a few handsful of topsoil. Soon, however, he was racked by powerful sobs that swiftly exhausted him and left him too weak to struggle with reality any longer. She was dead. Gone. Forever. As the cold rain fell in greater volume pounding on Candy's back, it seemed to leech his hot grief from him and fill him instead with icy hatred. Frank had killed their mother. He must pay for that crime with his own life. Lying on a muddy grave and weeping like a child would not bring Candy one step closer to vengeance. Finally, he got up and stood with his hands fisted at his sides, letting the storm sluice some of the mud and grief from him. He promised his mother that he would be more relentless and diligent in his pursuit of her killer. The next time he got a lead on Frank, he would not lose him. Looking up at the cloud-choked and streaming sky, addressing his mother in heaven, he said, "I'll find Frankie. Kill him, crush him, I will. I'll smash his skull open and cut his hateful brain into pieces and flush it down a toilet." The rain seemed to penetrate him, driving a chill deep into his marrow, and he shuddered. "If I find anyone who lifted a hand to help him, I'll cut their hands off. I'll tear out the eyes of anyone who looked at Frankie with sympathy, I swear I will. And I'll cut out the tongues of any bastards who spoke kind words to him." Suddenly the rain fell with greater force than before, hammering the grass flat, crackling through the leaves of a nearby oak, stirring a chorus of whispers from the Eugenias. It snapped against his face, making him squint, but he did not lower his eyes from heaven. "If he's found anyone to care about, anyone at all, I'll take them away from him like he took you away from me. I'll break them open, get the blood out of them, and throw them away like garbage." He had made these same promises many times during the past 7 years, but he made them now with no less passion than he had before. "Like garbage," he repeated through clenched teeth. His need for vengeance was no less fierce now than it had been on the day of her murder, 7 years ago. His hatred of Frank was, if anything, harder and sharper than ever. Like garbage. An axe of lightning cleaved the contusive sky. Briefly, a long, jagged laceration opened in the dark clouds, which for a moment seemed to him not like clouds at all, but like the infinitely strange and throbbing body of some godlike being.